from WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Extreme heat in Europe and the continental U.S. has made headlines this summer. What you may not have heard about is what's been going on in Alaska. 90-degree temperatures in the Arctic, wildfires and rare lightning storms, and the ground literally collapsing due to the melting of permafrost. A team of scientists and students with the Woods Hole Research Center's Polaris Project are just back from a trip to the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta to study climate impacts. And lead scientist Sue Natale joins me now to share what they saw and experienced and what it means for the entire globe. Sue, welcome back to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you, Heather. Thank you for having me.
You have been doing work in the Alaskan Arctic for several years. What made this year different in terms of the changes that you were seeing in the Arctic, in the ecosystems where you work?
There were a number of extreme changes that I saw this year that I hadn't ever experienced before. One was just the temperature was quite extreme. So we hit days of 90 degrees Fahrenheit, which I had never experienced before.
I mean, that's hot here, but to be in the Alaskan Arctic and it's 90 degrees.
Yeah, that's extremely hot. I mean, as a scientist, it's really challenging to work because you're wearing long pants and field boots and, you know, carrying heavy packs. There's no AC. You know, we're living out in tents. And so your tent is just boiling at night when you get back in it. And, you know, what I remind myself is that we're just there for a few weeks or just there for the summer. And there are people who are living this extreme temperature all the time. And so it was really a challenge. The other thing that was challenging about this summer was the air quality was extremely poor. I did notice that there seemed to be a lot more allergens was one thing, just pollen from plants. But what was even worse was the fire and the smoke. We were surrounded by smoke, and there were several days where between 90 degrees Fahrenheit and being surrounded by smoke, it was really, really hard to walk very far. It was hard just to, there was nowhere to get away from the smoke. The other thing that was unusual about this year is we had lightning storms. That's not that common in the tundra. It's actually not something when we sort of do our safety preparations, it actually hasn't been something that we've focused on, but we had several days of lightning storms. And, you know, imagine being in the tundra where there's no trees and there's no buildings. You are the highest item on the landscape. So that's also a safety concern. In addition to the warm air temperatures, soil temperatures were really warm. So we installed temperature sensors down to a meter in what was permafrost or should be permafrost. In 2017, the temperature was minus 0.6 degrees Celsius, which is just about thawing. Last year it was minus 0.3, and this year it was minus 0.1.
So we talk about extremes here of temperatures when we're talking about warmth, right? 90 degrees for the air, that sounds warm. What you're talking about here are still freezing temperatures.
Yeah, it's still freezing, but when you're at that point of freezing, so the ground stays frozen. The permafrost is ground that stays frozen, and it occurs across large areas of the Arctic. When you go from frozen state to thawed state, another extreme thing we saw was pretty substantial ground collapse. And I have never seen the level of ground collapse that I saw this year in 1 year's time before, ever.
So, I mean, what do you mean by ground collapse?
So the surface of the ground thaws and refreezes annually. Underneath that is permafrost. So this is just ground that stays frozen. It also contains ice. So when the ice melts, it turns to water. Water has less of a volume than ice, a smaller volume, and it also can run away. So this permafrost that's basically creating this hard ground, once it thaws, the ground can literally collapse. And so we've had places where, say, we set up a transect last year, and now 10 meters of that transect is gone. The ground kind of has just fallen into a wetland or fallen into a lake. There were areas where the ground was opening up. You can see the roots of plants just being pulled by the ground opening up, and you could stand, you know, a meter down into the ground. And there's a lot of things concerning about that. I mean, you can imagine if you had a house built on this.
You know,
there's a lot of communities in Alaska are having to deal with this, and that's a problem. A lot of the focus of my work is on carbon emissions from thawing permafrost. So you have this ground that was frozen that, one, is supporting the ground surface, but it also stored a lot of carbon. It just was frozen in the ground, frozen organic material. And there's this gradual thawing. But all of a sudden, when this ground cracks and opens up, you have the ground going from just having, say, the top 50 centimeters be thawed. Now it's thawed down to a meter and a half. And you can see, you can just see the entire soil profile. You can stand in this crack and just see the ground opening up.
Hmm. Sue Natale, you're there to study climate change, as you said, in part studying how, as the permafrost starts to thaw, how that might affect how much carbon is released into the atmosphere. What about this year? I mean, is this just one bad year, one extreme year, or does this to you scream out this is climate change and that it's accelerating?
It's definitely climate change and it's accelerating. And the past couple years have been particularly bad. The past winters have been warm. There's been rain when there should be snow. The ground hasn't been frozen. In this area, the surface of the ground didn't freeze until mid-January this year. Hmm. And so then you have that lag of that frozen ground. It was warmer, and then that goes into the summer, and that's why you're resulting in this ground cracking. It definitely is accelerating. And the problem is, once you have an abrupt event like this, the ground cracks and opens up. It's not something that can just be undone by a cold year, because you've already sort of exposed all this ground. Some of the material is just falling into lakes. Like, you're losing ground material, and you just can't go back in a human relevant time frame.
One of the things, as we said, you're studying is what happens to that carbon as the ground melts, as it's exposed and kind of crumbling like this. What are you learning about that? I mean, what is the scope or the scale of the potential release of carbon as this happens?
The location where I just came from is in southwest Alaska. It's in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, and it's in a tundra region. It's filled with wetlands. So one of the things we've been focusing on is sort of the effects of permafrost thaw, but also the effects of fire, because there's, even though it's wetland, surprisingly, there are fires that happen. And this combination of fire and these warming temperatures is a bad combination
Double
in terms
whammy.
Of carbon emissions, for sure. I mean, we've seen, you know, twice the amount of ground thaw, say, even outside of these areas that are cracking. So last year in the burned areas in July, the ground that was thawed was about 50 centimeters deep, and then you get to frozen soil. This year it was more than a meter in many areas. I've never, ever seen a change like that from one year to the next, ever. We're seeing areas that burned, wetland areas that are maybe not directly impacted by the fire, but downslope from the fire, higher methane emissions from some of these areas, because you're getting materials that are running off from the area that burned. Some of these slumping areas are providing a source of material for microbes in water bodies. So we're seeing higher methane emissions from areas where the ground is collapsing. One thing that one of the students that was with our group measured this year was nitrous oxide concentrations in soils that were quite high, much higher than atmospheric. And this is something we hadn't measured in past years. In undisturbed tundra, we have never seen nitrous oxide emissions. So nitrous oxide is another greenhouse gas. It's more than 100 times more potent than carbon Wow. dioxide. And so these are new observations.
Obviously, a lot we still don't know.
There's a lot we don't know. And these abrupt changes are the type of things that concern me, because, you know, when we try to model how permafrost will thaw and how much carbon emissions will come out from permafrost thaw, it's these sort of abrupt events that are really tricky to get into the models. And so when this is modeled, it's this gradual top-down thawing and this gradual release. But then you have an abrupt event where the ground cracks open. You have this huge area that's thawed that we didn't expect to thaw. And then that all dumps into a lake, which is a nice environment for methane production. And all
for
of a sudden,
bacteria
there's
or
for bacteria. Yeah. And all of a sudden, you have this source of carbon that just was dumped into it, a source of nutrients that was just dumped into it. And these are these processes that it's not that scientists don't know that they can happen. I think they're just happening at a faster rate, and they're just also hard to put into a model.
And so they're not, it sounds like, being really accounted for when we're thinking about, you know, how much carbon is in the atmosphere now, how much carbon is likely to be in the atmosphere in 5, 10, 50 years.
These abrupt events are definitely, yeah, they're definitely not accounted for. I mean, just even carbon emissions from permafrost are generally not accounted for into, so the last models, global climate models that informed our sort of international community in terms of decision-making about reducing fossil fuel emissions. So the IPCC reports, the permafrost carbon emissions didn't go into that accounting. We're working to put it into the models, but that's, we haven't even begun to really put in all of these processes, these abrupt events, the interaction of fire and what fire does to permafrost thaw. I would say we're being quite conservative when we make our estimates about how much carbon will be released from thawing permafrost because of these sort of surprising events.
And what are those estimates right now? I mean, how does what's going on in the Arctic compare to all of the fossil fuel burning that's going on around the world?
Yeah, so there's some range in the estimates, but about estimated about 150 billion tons of carbon will be released from thawing permafrost by the end of the century if we continue to emit fossil fuel emissions at our current rate. So to put that,
so, yeah, what
yeah,
does that
so
mean?
What does that mean? 150 billion tons. It sounds like a lot, and it is a lot. U.S. emissions right now are about 1.5 billion tons per year. So if we think about
that, 100 years worth of U.S. emissions.
Yeah, if we think about it, though, it's another fossil fuel emitting country, right? So by the end of the century, 150 billion from thawing permafrost, that's on par with the U.S. emission rate. And this is something we're not accounting for. You know, U.S. is the second largest fossil fuel emitter. We would never not account for the U.S. emissions in our budgeting. And so I think it's, you know, our ability to keep our global temperature below 2 degrees Celsius is dependent upon accounting for all of the sources of carbon that we can expect to go into the atmosphere.
Well, it's not just reliant on us accounting for them. It's reliant on us also controlling them. And this is a source that we can't really control. We can't turn off the tap. We don't have a way of just saying to the permafrost, all right, time to stop thawing and stop emitting now.
Well, by, you know, because carbon dioxide, methane are global greenhouse gases, emissions that we reduce in all parts of the world will also reduce carbon that comes out of permafrost, right? So as we keep our global temperatures down, that means less permafrost will thaw. As less permafrost thaws, then more of the carbon will stay locked away in the permafrost.
That's one way that the cycle could go, right? But that's the virtuous cycle, I guess. That if we control warming from fossil fuels, we can control the release from permafrost thawing, but that can work in the opposite direction as well, right? That the more warming there is, the more carbon dioxide there is released, the more warming there is. I mean, it just kind of keeps going.
Yeah, it does keep going. But it's not, you know, some permafrost has already thawed and some will continue to thaw. And so it's not a hopeless case, right? Like there's nothing we can do because the permafrost carbon has thawed and some carbon is being released. You know, keeping at our current rate of fossil fuel emissions, we may lose 70% of permafrost, but greatly reducing it, we may only thaw 30%. And that's a big difference. That's a huge range. It means a lot to the people who are living in the permafrost region, whose homes are in the permafrost region. Some people are already being impacted and will continue to be impacted, but I think sort of the urgency of reducing fossil fuel emissions will certainly make a difference. Acting now will make a huge difference from acting in 10 years, in 20 years, or in 30 years.
How do you personally deal with what must be a psychological and an emotional burden coming from the knowledge that you have of what's going on? You're seeing how ecosystems and communities are being affected. You understand how what's going on in the Arctic could affect all of us by releasing all of these greenhouse gases. I mean, how do you kind of cope with all of that?
Sometimes it's challenging. I think the thing that helps me to cope with it is I know that knowing is better than not knowing, right? You know, I mean, even with a disease, you may not want to hear that you have something wrong with you, but you're a lot better off because then you can start figuring out a solution. And so I don't like the news, and it's not good news, but being ignorant of the news isn't going to help at all, right? So having the knowledge that I do, at least I can talk to people about it. At least I can try to talk with policymakers. At least I can try to sort of push to have, you know, the handle turn so we can reduce our fossil fuel emissions and to increase that urgency, it would still be happening if I knew nothing. And I don't think I would be any better off.
That's Sue Natale of Woods Hole Research Center. Sue, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much, Heather.
Up next, it's not just cars and power plants. Every little thing we buy or use has an environmental impact. Living Lab Radio continues after the break.